talking about the philosophical issues. And so I hope that our philosophical friends, both here and over there in Western, will participate more and contribute more. I'm going to embarrass myself, since I'm not a professionally trained philosopher, by speaking about philosophical issues and the history of philosophy, of the issues of space and time, and I fully expect to be corrected, to be jumped on, and I very much hope that from this point on, the class will be more of a discussion and a confrontation. We've had the basics of the framework to raise the issue of time in general relativity and quantum gravity and quantum cosmology. We're not going to forget those things. We're going to come back to them. But what I want to do today, and this is a class mostly for the physicists, because the philosophers will know all these things, but will help out by correcting my naivete. I'm very hopeful. I'm sure there's a lot of naivete in my view and my telling of the issues, but let's see. So before launching into a discussion, which I'll do from the computer, I want to raise an issue and also suggest a kind of framework for thinking. To me, it's remarkable in some of the historical literature in Newton and Leibniz, as I'll be discussing, space and time are always linked. And one always takes the same attitude towards the issues, the philosophical issues regarding the nature of space, the issues regarding the nature of time. And that's my first issue is, should timely issues, and I don't know what to call them, spatially issues, be linked? And let me show you what I mean by suggesting at least one framework for situating points of view and ideas. So a very traditional way to talk about the philosophy of space and time is in terms of what allegedly, and I'm not a historian, if I'm not a philosopher, I'm especially not a historian, but naive readings of the history are given in which there's an argument between relationalism as a point of view, and I don't know which way I want to go, and absolutism. And I'll be discussing what these things mean, but roughly speaking, absolutism with respect to space means that space exists independently of things that exist inside of space, and it has all its properties independently of things that exist in space. And similarly, in time and relationalism, in space says that space is just an aspect of some set of relational or properties or relationships amongst things. And these, as you'll see, are spoken about equally with respect to space and time and, very famously at the same time. Now, that's sort of one axis. And by the way, I'm aware that there are other more recent philosophers, like contemporary philosophers, who use other words, and I hope maybe that some of the philosophers present will illuminate us. There is substantivalism. There is structuralism, and so forth. And I have to admit, I have a hard time really understanding what those views are. So I hope that the philosophers in the audience will, a little bit later, I'll raise the question, will tell us, because there's supposed to be more intelligent versions of something between relationalism and absolutism. Okay, but there's also issues with respect to time that don't have analogs with respect to space. For example, the issue of block universe. And I've already messed up what I wanted to do on the blackboard, but okay. Block universe. And that can be contrasted with, and not the only two views, but that can be contrasted with presentism. So, and another name for the block universe is, or something like it, is eternalism. So roughly speaking, these things mean what the words mean. So presentism is the view that the only thing that is real is what is real now, that there is a succession of nows, and that we're in a particular now, now, and that reality refers to things that are real now. This can of soda is real. We're in this room. This is real. The Civil War, the American Civil War, excuse me, is not real. The year 3000 is not real. The future and the past are not real. What is real is only what is real now. And the opposing point of view is that what is real is the whole of the history of the world. And the moment now is in reality no more real than any other moment, and that all the moments are equally real, or what is real is the whole history, and which implies that the experience of time that we have is to some degree an illusion. So this is another pole that the discussion revolves around, and of course there are other points of view in between, like the present is real, the past in a somewhat different sense is real, but it's still real, and the future is not. I forget what that's called, but that is a view. But notice that, except to kind of make a philosophical joke, you don't hear people talking about here-ism. That is, you don't see the same issues raised with respect to space, although sometimes if somebody, there's a cheap argument made against presentism where people say, well, you think only the now is real, but you don't think certainly the here is the only real.
Platform from the Republican Party of the U.S.
You're on a
political. Here is real and everything else is
We Americans are in an interesting state of mind these days, are we not? Yes.
And except, I mean, we have something similar to this theorism, and I think it's from the Hegelianism. It's kind of realism. It says that, I mean, what we're looking at right now is the things that we have in the world. And for example, if I look at a tree last minute, or you know, 1 hour's growth, there isn't right now here and there. And so it's just the things that we're looking here, and everything that's in the world or is real, is like, is the things that we are looking at.
Right. So there is a view, there is solipsism, which is not exactly what you're saying, but it's might be a related view, that the only thing that's actually real is my perception of the world. And my perception of the world is centered on, quote, where I am.
Yeah.
No. But even people who are, you might imagine somebody who was a realist, that was not a solipsist, but would be a theorist and would be skeptical about the reality of things that were far away in space. Yes?
So how can presentism be compatible with special relativity? Because you need to single out like a specific hypersurface?
Why would it need to be global?
Well, I mean, then you would say kind of in one frame, okay, this hypersurface is real.
You can have nouns at different points all the way up this. You don't need one now to be in the entire space.
Well, but
so then it's like observability.
It could be like a local point.
Yeah, okay, you have now here and you have now there, but they need to be on the same hypersurface.
No. Let's put this. I mean, I what you're saying is good, but this is an argument which is given routinely against presentism. So let's put it on the board. I wasn't intending to do this till later, but why not? Let me put it on the board. Let me make the argument. And then let's discuss it for a minute. And then I would like to suggest an option and then come back to it. So, you know, consider that this is Minkowski space-time. Okay, so this is roughly the time direction. More importantly, there are invariant structures which are light cones. And if we happen to be at this event, is there an ambiguity in talking about what is real is what is real right now? Because I might be talking about this now. Let's call that now one. Right? It might be talking about another space-like surface, which would be the surface of simultaneity for some other observer. Now two, or I might be talking about now three. Okay? And so, if I remember right, the argument which is made goes like the following. Assuming that special relativity is right, they have the same status. So whatever is true about any one is true about all of them. So if any of them are real, all of them are real. So then, quote, what's real is outside of our light cone at this moment. So that's already a blow against presentism, but it's worse than that, because then I might consider this observer over here, who is to the future of now one, but is simultaneous with me at now three, and I make the same argument with respect to them. And I discover that what's real, if what's real is now for them, it's the whole of the outside of their light cone, and I continue like this, and I cover the whole of Minkowski space-time. So I come to the Locke universe or eternalist point of view, that is, presentism plus Lorentz invariance seems to imply that actually all of Minkowski space-time is equally real. So that's the argument you have in mind.
Then you could make kind of an equivalence that you can have like presentism only in connection with like, I don't know, like as you said, theorism or localism. So that only like your one space-time point is real.
Yeah. Since you were arguing, do you have a comment?
No, that's kind of what I'm saying is that I don't see that there should be a public now as long as it's local.
As long as it's the local. Okay, so that's one option. So then it's sort of the space-like regions of one observer at one moment. Of course, another option is to turn it around and say that presentism implies that Lorentz invariance is false as far as reality is concerned. That is, it may be a true symmetry of nature, but when we're talking about what's really real, there is only one preferred simultaneity. So, in other words, there exists just, you know, a single real simultaneity. At any moment. For any of, yes.
Would you say more precisely what you mean by real?
No. No. I don't want to be too glib. I don't want to get into a deep discussion of realism. So let me say that I assume that when I use the word real, I assume that there exists a world which is independent of our perceptions of it and our discussions of it, and we're talking about things that are true in that world.
So like in classical theory, where you assume you have some inner state, and you, as opposed to a quantum theory where you could argue that you don't have, you can't make that assumption.
I'm sorry, what were the two theories?
Classical.
Classical. Oh, classical and quantum, yeah.
So it means you could, if you say something is real, then you can make a classical model of it. Where you have a set of states and you describe knowledge in general.
It's a little bit more, this is one reason I don't want to get off on it, is because there are views about quantum mechanics which are claimed to be realism, aspects of realism. And there are views of quantum mechanics which respect the dichotomy you're making. And I don't, maybe we need to go into it, but let me just try to hold on to this naive point of view that there is an external reality independent of our existence, perceptions, knowledge, discussion, and real means something is real if it is a true feature of that reality. And of course, there's the whole epistemological discussion of what we can know and how much we can know and how assured we can be by knowledge, but nonetheless, we can express a belief in that external world and it having properties which are true or false. Okay, any comment from Western? Or Guelph is there too. Any comments from? Is that a no? Okay. 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 So. To me, it's not entirely insane that some version of hereism might be appropriate. In cosmology, we are regularly now talking about the properties of the universe outside of our horizon, and there is an issue. You know, if something like eternal inflation is true, and the universe is infinitely big spatially, something is being asserted which is beyond what can be observed. And somebody might respond to that by some version of heroism. So I don't think it's completely crazy to come back and think about heroism. But anyway, I'm just laying out the contrast and the fact that we worry a lot about presentism versus eternalism and not so much about heroism versus not heroism is an indication, is an axis along which time is and space are very different, whereas this relational versus absolute time, as we'll see, is paired. Okay. Yes?
Is there really such a big difference between heroism and nowism? Because, if I want to know what's here, that's what I know is real. But if I want to know that that point over there is real, I need to get a light signal to tell me that that point exists. And then that's something that happened in the past. I need to know if, you know, what, whether or not the thing that happened in the past is real, if I want to know something over there.
Mm-hmm.
There.
So, excuse me. So you might take a view that your backward light cone is real. There's you're an observer here. So here's a might be a contemporary version of presentism. You think that there's a real now associated with the moment, but you think that it's your backward light cone. And something is real in this moment if it is an event on the background, your backward light cone. And of course, that is dependent on where you are in space as well. But you might take that point of view. Backward light cone-ism. Okay. Okay, so what I propose to do, this is just sort of to get us started, is to look for a few minutes at Newton and Leibniz and just see how the issue is raised, and not so much by them, if I can be a little postmodern about it, how the issue is raised by all the philosophers of science who always raise them when you start the discussion. And then I'd like to follow that with what I think is the what we mean by relationalism versus absolutism as working physicists, which is somewhat different. Okay. And so the first, these two things are on the computer, if the computer is still working. And maybe since I'm going to want to point the thing, I'll get a stick. Can you, everybody out there, see the computer? Do you see the display when it goes up? No. Can you yet? It would be not yet. Can you see it now? Okay. Person downstairs in the booth, is can we switch over to the computer? Of course, in Western, you guys are philosophers. You know all this stuff by heart. You probably could dictate these texts. Okay. Do you see them yet? Okay. Well, I'll read. Okay, and we'll see how this works. Okay, so there isn't so much now, but actually it would. What? I don't control the view. There is a person down there, isn't there? Isn't that just a motion sensor? I think. Okay. Okay. So let's give this a try. So this is Newton wrote this great book, the Principia, in 1687, and this was the Scholium, which is a fancy word apparently for the introduction or philosophical reflections that go with the introduction. And these are famous words, so I'll read them. I'll read the first three paragraphs, and then maybe we can stop and discuss. I'll, of course, feel free to editorialize since I'm the person reading. So hitherto, I have laid down the definition of such words as less known and explained in the sense I would like to have them understood. I do not define time, space, place, and motion as being well known to all. Only I must observe that the vulgar conceive these quantities under no other notions but from the relation they bear to sensible objects. And thence arise certain prejudices for the removing of which it will be convenient to distinguish them into absolute and relative, true and apparent, mathematical, and common. So let's pause there. Any comment? I mean, what is this guy doing? He starts, and of course I have no way of knowing if the translation is a decent translation or anything, but he uses a value-laden word, vulgar, and basically says there are vulgar people out there who conceive of these words, space and time, place and motion, under no other notions but from the relations they bear to sensible objects. Okay, that is, you know, here means the thing is sitting over here on the table. There means it's up there on the ceiling. Now is now, you know, tomorrow is the next day and so forth as we perceive it. And thence arise certain prejudices, another value-laden claim, for the removing of which he will distinguish things into absolute and relative, true and apparent, mathematical, and common. So look, what's going on here, and somebody please interrupt me if you think I'm being too prejudicial, but what's going on here is a play to replace our knowledge gotten from our perceptions of the world, from our knowledge from something which is absolute and timeless and so forth. That is, right at the beginning, he's distinguishing something, you know, the absolute, true, and mathematical go together. So if something is true, it's absolutely true, it's also mathematically true. Relative, apparent, and common go together. Common means, I guess, like common sense. So if something is true relatively, then it's only apparent, it's not true, that is, you're being deceived if you believe it. And it's commonly deceived. So this is a lot of propaganda. And of course, Newton was, you know, it would be nice if more people wrote as clearly as Newton. Seriously, Newton was a great scientist and a great writer. And he's getting the blow in at the very, so if you buy this, you're finished, I think. Discussion is over if you buy this. So maybe you do buy this, but maybe we shouldn't buy this. Okay, and then, sure, please, I want you to. Sure, my comment is not a very serious or scholarly comment, but I don't know if words like vulgar and prejudices had the same weight. If I say to a colleague in physics that your views are vulgar and prejudice, you know, reflect prejudices, I'm not attacking their view, I'm attacking their character. I mean, you're right, this can be taken as we're going to introduce technical language, but, you know, and therefore we're going to define things more precisely, but I mean, you know, you don't have to be a feminist scholar to look out for when people introduce, technical language, they're trying to pull over some metaphysical point of view on you. Anyway, that's just, you know, that's just for entertainment, okay, if you don't buy it. Let's get into paragraph two, because this is the key thing. Okay, absolute true and mathematical time of itself and from its own nature flows equably without regard to anything external, and by another name is called duration. So let's forget the last phrase, which I find confusing, and by another name is called duration. I mean, that's fine, but the key thing is, so he's defining, he said we're going to distinguish absolute true and mathematical things from relative, apparent, and common things. So now he says, let's start with time. Absolute true and mathematical time flows equally without regard to anything external, and is of itself and from its own nature. So this is a view of time in which we would say, in a more modern way, there is a geometry associated with time, there is a metric associated with time, there is an order associated with time, and all these properties, when applied to this absolute mathematical time, are true irrespective of anything else. By anything external, I presume he means anything apart from time. So nothing, whether the configuration of matter in the universe, the emotions of people in the room, the temperature, anything else that you might think affects the ticking of a clock or the perception of time does not affect this mathematical time. And so this is a statement of what's called the absolute point of view about time. Okay. And then he goes on and says, absolute time is to be contrasted with relative, apparent, and common time. Again, the three things against the three things, which is some sensible and external measure of duration by the means of motion, which is commonly used instead of true time, such as an hour, a day, a month, a year. So he says, he contrasts it with relational or relative time. Sorry, relational is my word, relative time, parent time, which is measured by means of motion of something, whether by clocks or the planets or the Earth's rotation or the moon or something like that. And this is a distinction that is necessary for Newton to frame physics as he does. And let me just say, before we get to space, let me just say what I think is the issue. Let me find my eraser. So supposing, well, in dynamics of particles, there occur a lot of expressions like x of t, you know, is vt plus a over 2t squared plus et cetera. And we'll come to the issue of position, but if you take this point, if you don't take Newton's point of view, then the question is, what is t refer to? Well, you do experiments, or you roll a ball down an inclined plane, you drop, you throw an eraser in the air, and so forth. Okay, what is the t refer to so that when you measure the path, it's a parabola? Well, you have some clock of some kind, and then you can ask, but supposing you use a different clock, supposing we use the motion of the Earth, supposing we use a water clock, supposing we use a pendulum, how do you know that there's going to be the same relation for all the different clocks? And how do you know, is that if you don't, is there any, if time is just what's measured by motion, do you have a problem of circularity? That is, you might get yourself into a situation where you think that, well, this doesn't say anything to do with nature, because I could just define a clock to be an object that when I measured certain motions with certain, when I measure certain motions, satisfied that formula. So one could take, that's called a conventionalist point of view, in which one just defines space and time to be whatever they need to be, so that the formulas you want turn out to be true, roughly speaking. So there's a big issue, or if you think that, you know, time is the result of some vast network of relationships, like we do in general relativity, then you would have to solve a big, huge equation involving all the relationships of all the bodies in the world and all their motion in order to make sense of whether that was the right trajectory for a particle or not, and that would be very hard. So as not, it's more than a practical matter. If you, so I was very struck at some point, I don't remember where Einstein said it, but Einstein at some point praised Newton's courage and wisdom for adopting this point of view about time. And the case for that is really what I'm trying to make, that is, by claiming that this has meaning apart from how a particular clock runs or how the Earth rotates or anything else involving motion that's measurable, he greatly simplifies his life. He can assert that there's some law of nature which knows about this mathematical absolute time, and with respect to which statements of this kind for the motion of a particle are true or false, and you can cleanly separate the issue of errors in the measurement from the issue of whether the law is true or not. That is, Newton still has, as anybody would have, an issue of when you're going to verify the formula in an experiment, you're going to use a clock of some kind to measure the duration or the time elapsed, and that will be only approximately, for any particular clock, that will only be approximately related to this true mathematical time. But nonetheless, the fact that there is a real thing called the true mathematical time makes it possible to separate conceptually the issue of errors in reading the clock from a much more complicated issue of ambiguity as to what time is if time is just motion. Okay, so is that clear? So that's, before we criticize Newton, I think it has to be recognized the power of the move that he made. Yes?
I mean that in the Newtonians, for example, we need the motion like circulating or oscillating, not just moving in a straight direction, to find a clock or stuff.
If we were willing to have a long enough linear motion would be fine, since we have the principle of inertia.
And then we have to divide it by separate times, and how we can understand that the velocity is constant there if we don't have any circulation or as a, because we need periodic motion to understand the clock, the tick of the clock.
Sure, but there are difficulties with the theory of any clock. And there are instrumental difficulties but I'm making a simpler point. And the simpler point that I'm making is that Newton could cleanly separate those instrumental difficulties from straightforward issues of whether these were the right laws or not. Okay, or you know, when Newton wrote, you know, mass times acceleration is force, he could rely on, you know, the acceleration is d squared x dt squared, and he could rely on that being a meaningful quantity. Therefore, mass is a meaningful quantity, therefore force is a meaningful quantity, and so forth. Yes?
So do I understand right? Like he says, like the true time would be our day month, would be now our day or month. Or
no, no. He contrasts. Which is absolute time, and I didn't check the scholarly whatever, so I'm not sure what this. I just got this off the web, like any high school kid. Written for a paper. So I don't know what the in parentheses refer to, but absolute time is to be contrasted with the other kind of time, relative, apparent, and common time, which is sensible and external, whether accurate or unequivocal, I presume means not, measure of duration by the means of motion. So duration is the absolute time, duration is the t. And then there's another thing, let's call it capital T, which approximates the true time, which you would be measuring by a real clock in a real experiment. Okay. Okay. Any more comments on this? The computer is supposed to respond by switching the page, right? Push that button. There. Okay. Okay, so this is the next paragraph, and it corresponds, it's the same thing with respect to space, and it's almost the same words. Absolute space in its own nature without regard to anything external. Yes, please. I feel embarrassed, by the way, I know you're, you know, this is an area in which you're scholarly. I feel embarrassed even mentioning this stuff, but go ahead.
Zero time, yes.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you. And where is that? Is that further down in this folium or? Okay. Excuse me. I'm not going to try to find it here because this is all I prepared to show. But let me ask you this. I mean, there's a view which is ascribed to Newton as sort of the bad guy in the absolute relative debate, which I'll come to. And what I imagine is it's possible to make a claim that Newton was not that bad guy. He was just very clear, thinking very clearly about what one had to do precisely what you read, that is, to separate out from the confusion of the possible different measurements and changes in measurements and so forth, something that the theory referred to when it referred to time. Is that fair? Yeah. No. So let me go on a little bit, and then let's come back to that, if that's okay. 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 So just to go on a little bit, so we're back on paragraph 3. Relative space, that's again the other kind of space, is some movable dimension or measure of the absolute space, which our senses determine by its position to bodies. So what he means is a ruler. I want to measure the length of something. I don't think I have a ruler in this room, but this hockey stick is so long, and I am 1 point something hockey sticks high today, et cetera. So there's the same contrast between absolute space, the real distance that something may occupy in space, the real length that something may have, and how we determine it by using a ruler or some other measurement. Okay, and so this is the same logic as before, but the next bit is sort of interesting. So which our senses determine by its position to bodies. I think that just means we line up rulers with bodies and measure their lengths. And which is vulgarly taken for immovable space, such. And let me ask you as a scholar, because this I have a little bit of trouble with, such is the dimension of a subterranean, aerial, or celestial space determined by its position in respect of the Earth. Is there a clear reading of that? Long sign. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, yeah, John.
This is very rusty.
But can you hear when somebody speaks in the audience here?
Okay. I think also but I'm very rusty on this. Wasn't there a sense in Aristotelian physics that space was associated with what we would call the boundary separating, the boundary defining it? So Aristotle, if I remember correctly, always understood space in terms of being bounded by something. So the space inside a box, what we would say is inside the box, is really for Aristotle defined by the by what we would say was the surface of the box. So if you're talking about a subterranean cavity, then from that, if I've got it right, from that Aristotelian point of view, the cavity would define the space, and Newton's saying that's not true, right? That's an artificial thing.
Comment?
Yeah, good. Okay, so there, from here on, I don't think the rest of this is very important. Absolute and relative space are the same figure in magnitude, but they do not always remain numerically the same. That is, there can be errors in the correspondence. If the Earth, for example, moves a space of our air, which relatively and with respect to the Earth remains always the same, will be one part of absolute space into which the air passes another time. It will be another part of the same absolute space. So the idea is distinguishing clearly, as the Earth moves, something which is stationary with respect to the Earth, say the air, has the same position with respect to the Earth. And so if you define relative space with respect to the Earth does not move, but passes through absolute space. And I think this makes it clear that what he means when he's referring to absolute space is something like what we mean when we say there's a manifold and all the points of the manifold are distinguishable. So it makes sense to say, now this chalk is at one point of the manifold, now at another, and so on. Okay, so there's much more we could say about Newton, and thanks for reading that further down in the scholium. I'm going to go on to Leibniz for the contrast. Leibniz, to me, I should say, it's very easy to call oneself a Leibnizian as a certain kind of physicist these days, and I have done so, but I've actually, it's remarkable. Leibniz is very difficult, and for those of you who haven't in the class, it's worth reading what I'm going to be quoting from briefly in a minute, which is the correspondence between Leibniz and Clark, who was an associate of Newton's. And it's also worth trying to read The Monadology, which is a short book, which I find very provocative. I don't want to discuss it today, but I want to discuss it later on, because I want to reread it and re-provoke myself. But I certainly don't think I understand Leibniz very well. I certainly don't have a global picture of what his key concerns were and key ideas. So the following is done with even more sense of embarrassment than the discussion of Newton. Okay, so, and this comes from, so Leibniz and Newton had a controversy over the foundations of physics. They also had other controversies, for example, over the priority to the invention of calculus. And this is from an exchange of letters that went through a Princess Caroline, I believe was her name, between Clark, who was an associate of Newton's, and Leibniz. And these are, what I'm going to be quoting is a little bit from some of Leibniz's exchanges. But the whole thing is not very long, and it's worth reading. So he starts by introducing a principle, which is the principle of sufficient reason, which he keeps going back to, so I wanted to start with this. So he starts by saying, the great foundation of mathematics is the principle of contradiction, or identity, that is, a proposition cannot be true and false at the same time. And that therefore A is A and cannot be not A. This single principle is sufficient to demonstrate every part of arithmetic and geometry, that is all mathematical principles. So this is not, he's just introducing this to claim something about his principle, but that's a, you know, even that is a very, at least I'm not sure how strong or how that claim is. That is, my impression is that to demonstrate propositions in arithmetic and geometry, I need more than a principal contradiction, and I also need some axioms. But anyway, that he's claiming that all mathematics is erected on one principle. And then he goes on to claim that when you proceed to natural philosophy, there's also only one principle, which is the principle of sufficient reason, that nothing happens without a reason why it should be so and not otherwise. And that's the full statement of the principle, as far as I know. And the application of the principle we'll see in a little bit, but it means that if you claim that something has a property or an event occurs and you're not able to provide an explanation why it should have that property and not a different property, or why it should have occurred rather than something else occurred, then that thing cannot have that property and that event cannot have occurred. That's the meaning of that principle. It's a destructive principle. It limits what could exist. And we'll see. So then he makes a huge claim, which I just to show that we're not dealing with somebody of small ego here or self-regard. Now by that single principle that there ought to be a sufficient reason why things should be so and not otherwise, when they demonstrate the being of God and all the other parts of metaphysics or natural theology, and even in some measure those principles of natural philosophy that are independent upon mathematics, I mean the dynamical principles or the principles of force. So that's a huge claim which has not stood up historically. maybe that's all that needs to be said. But nonetheless, as we'll see, and maybe it's just that physics is not advanced far enough. Maybe there will be someday a physics where the principle of sufficient reason is sufficient to determine what the dynamics is. That would certainly make our work easier if it were true. But he does, it seems to me, even this, if you leave aside this exaggerated claim, it does work very powerfully in discussions about the nature of space and time. So let's turn to that. Okay, so this is his basic claim. As for my own opinion, so this is, and this is in order of, I mean, this is not nearly his full responses in the correspondence, but this is in order. As for my own opinion, I have said more than once that I hold space to be something nearly relative as time is, that I hold it to be an order of coexistences as time is an order of successions. So that's a full statement of a view. So space is merely relative, i.e. not the absolute space of Newton, and an order of coexistences. So what that means roughly is things that exist at the same time. So there's a notion of simultaneity. And the things that exist at the same time have various orders and relationships amongst them. And space is one of those. If those things did not exist, then there would not be any order of coexistence and there would not be space. And for space denotes, in terms of possibility, an order of things which exist at the same time, considered as existing together without inquiring into their manner of existing. So I'm not quite sure why that caveat is there, but the first part of it I think is clear. Space denotes an order of things which exist at the same time, so I'm just repeating. Without requiring into their manner of existing, I suppose says that we're not going to get into metaphysical issues, we're not going to get into a variety of issues about how and why things exist, but we're going to take it for granted that things exist at the same time, and then they have various orders, or you might say relations amongst them, and space is an aspect of that. And then just to go back, time is also an order of successions. Time is also merely relative as an order of successions. That is, things that
succeed each other, that do not occur at the same time, have order amongst them, and time is an order of those things. Were there no events that succeeded each other, there would be no time. And to my knowledge, and again, I'm far from a Leibniz scholar, what Leibniz does not, so a modern relativist might here be talking about causality and referring to causal structure. Leibniz talks about succession, but he doesn't talk about causality. But please correct me if that may just be my incomplete reading of Leibniz. Okay, comments?
Okay, I'll go ahead. This
is probably a bit too much to get, so let me just pick out some of this. So this is his argument. We gave his principle of sufficient reason, then he states his view. Now here's the argument. I say then that if space were an absolute being, there would be something happen, there would something happen, that's not great English, but anyway, there would something happen for which it would be impossible there should be a sufficient reason, which is against my axiom. And I prove it thus, space is something absolutely uniform, and without the things placed in it, one point of space does not absolutely differ in any respect whatsoever from another point of space. Now, from whence it follows that, and let me, supposing space be something in itself, besides the order of bodies amongst themselves, that it's impossible there should be a reason why God, preserving the same situation of bodies amongst themselves, should have placed them in space after one particular manner and not otherwise, why everything was not placed in a quite contrary way, for example, by changing east into west. So his argument is, since space is uniform, if I give the relative positions of a group of bodies, say the bodies on this desk, there might be reasons for them, but if I were to move the whole world to a different configuration, retaining all the absolute configuration, all the relative configuration. So I take all the things that exist, I keep all the relative positions with respect to each other, and I move the world around respecting those relative configurations. For example, he doesn't mention this example here, but by translating the whole world 15 feet to the left, then two things. One of them, it makes sense to say that if space is absolute, because Newton has insisted that there's a difference between relative position and absolute position. And two, there could not be a sufficient reason why things were here and not 15 feet to the left, because any explanation, what's implicit here is any explanation has to do with relative positions. Forces have to do with relative positions. Properties have to do with relative positions. There couldn't possibly be a reason why God, and he brings God in here, would have to have moved things 15 feet to the left. So therefore, it can't make sense to distinguish between the two states of here and 15 feet to the left, because there's not a sufficient reason. So this is how the principle of sufficient reason acts destructively to label certain things that somebody might like to say meaningless or impossible to say. So that's the basic structure of the argument. Just one more comment, then I'll ask for comments. It's the example here that he gives is not moving everything 15 feet to the left. It's reflecting east into west, which is a very interesting example. I mean, it's parody. It's, the question is, would we reflect everything into the mirror image? And this is an interesting issue, and I'd like to come back to it at a later time, because as far as we know, physics is not parody invariant. And I know that some philosophers have written about the issue of parity and parity invariance and made reference to Leibniz. And there's an interesting discussion to have about parity, which just, I just want to bookmark that and come back to that. Okay, let me, I think the rest is basically just rubbing in the argument in slightly different words than I did, but let me ask any comment. Yes.
Well, so as soon as you introduce a record of some position without actually being something at the place with introduced information, and once you introduce information, that information is always tied to matter in some sense, and then kind of you have already introduced in some sense like a point.
Well, but
and from that point on, you can start, well, okay, I'm in position relative to whatever is the record of the information of location.
But I don't see how that gets out of this status. So I write down on a piece of paper, you know, the location of something.
Yeah, okay, so then I can say, okay, I'm in position relative to your piece of paper.
Right, sure, but you can all, but you're still, that's not, that Leibniz has no problem with that. That's a relative position, and Leibniz has no problem with relative positions. He's arguing against the notion that anything, that there's any notion of position except relative position. So I think keeping records is all within the I think Leibniz is happy that we keep records. Mm-hmm. Okay, comment in Western as well? Sure. Very good, good. So do you mind if I just expand to get that? Because that's a very important issue. And I mean, we're not going to resolve here the scholarly issue about Newton, but thank you for raising this. So in fact, when Newton gets done writing down his laws of nature, say for a system of particles, so he writes down, so the principle of inertia, so a particle, and I'll just say it, I think everybody knows what it is, but a particle with no forces on it continues to move with a constant velocity forever, or at rest being a special case of a constant velocity. And again, these are with respect to what he calls mathematical or absolute space and with respect to absolute time. So no forces implies the velocity is constant. And so then there's the equal and opposite law, which we can come back to. And then there's the third law that says when there are forces, the accelerations are the forces divided by the masses. Okay. And these have a symmetry. Sorry? Wait a minute, you mean, it's actually the, okay, I apologize. Okay, thank you. So, you know, to say from a modern point of view, these laws have some symmetries. And among the symmetries are translations in space, translations in time, and changes of inertial frame, what we would call Lorentz transformations, but that would be wrong. Changes of inertial frame. And so you can make the argument that whereas the reason why the laws have these symmetries is that acceleration, which is the second derivative of position with respect to time, is invariant under these symmetries. And therefore, the laws are meaningful. There's an interesting irony here, which is that the laws are meaningful with respect to what Newton calls relative space and relative, well, maybe this is not quite the right way to say it, but if you make a translation in space, you don't change the laws. If you make a translation in time, you don't change the laws. So I think what you're saying is that Newton and Leibniz would agree that what is absolute, or might agree about, that what is absolute about absolute space and time does not have to do with translating 15 feet to the left and does not have to do with setting your clock an hour later. It has to do only with accelerations, because accelerations can be claimed to have an absolute meaning. So is that more or less, I'm saying it badly, but is that the case you want to make? So so I'm just confused. I don't think I have a view of this. If I go back and I read what we were quoting from Newton, you know, even though I agree with you that later on, let me go to the space one. Later on, he does certainly accept the relativity of inertial frames, but nonetheless, this paragraph seems to me to say that he believes in absolute position. And you know, I don't know, at least for the purposes of this class, I don't know that we need to resolve this. Maybe something will come up later when we're dealing with the issues in a contemporary format. Would you be able to give a reference or find a place to look it up? So I'll just. Why don't you send the reference in, and if you can do better and come up with a PDF, I can distribute them. Okay. Yeah, good. So let's look at that as part for next time. Okay. I'm going to go on. Newton, there's nobody who is a greater physicist than Newton, and Newton is incomprehensible to me, but it is also possible that he was cagey, that he was confused. Leibniz is also, extraordinary, but it's possible. What certainly strikes me, I read through part of the Clark-Leibniz correspondence to prepare for this, and what struck me, and again, I'm not a scholar, is the sense that they were speaking past each other. And what also struck me is that I don't see any evidence, and again, your scholars, you may know, that Leibniz sort of understood the reasons for the practical success of Newton. That is, one can make an argument, and certainly some have, and I have on other occasions, that Leibniz was right philosophically, and ultimately, that the triumph of general relativity, or the experimental correctness of general relativity, is evidence for that. But I'm not aware of anywhere where Leibniz sort of says, oh, I see, if you invent this absolute space and absolute time, you can write down laws of motion that I wouldn't be able to write down if I was just a purely to think in terms of relational quantities. And I can apply those laws, and I get lots of interesting results. I mean, is there a passage in Leibniz like that somewhere? Okay, so that's interesting. I didn't know that. And okay, I think I'm almost done with Leibniz. So let's just mention about time, and again, this always this pairing of space with time, which is just something that I suggest we be critical about. So the case is the same with respect to time. Supposing one should ask why God did not create everything a year sooner, the same person should infer from thence that God had done something concerning which was not possible there should be a reason why he did it so and not otherwise. The answer is that his inference would be right if time were anything distinct from things existing in time. And so therefore he's arguing that time is not distinct from things existing in time. For it would be impossible that there should be any reason why things should be applied to such instance, particular instance, sorry, rather than to others, their succession continuing the same. But then the same argument proves that instance considered without things, that is in some, some belief in just the existence of a succession of instance without events, are nothing at all, and they consist only in the successive order of things, which order remaining the same, one of the two states, that is a supposed anticipation, would not at all differ, nor could be discerned from the other which now is. So I think that's reasonably clear. It's the use of the argument from sufficient reason, and it again argues against the notion of a notion of time apart from the succession of real events which give meaning or which are the moments. Yes, so one way to say the principle of sufficient reason in the modern way would is something like all quantities that a theory says are physically meaningful should be observable. And that's not the same principle, but it's a related, it's something that one might say. Okay, before I leave Newton and Leibniz, any more comments? And then I'm going to go to a more contemporary point of view. Okay, so and also let me ask a view about the class. I have a sense that because we're near an hour and a half, I have a sense that we could take a break now, but I could also sort of go on and we could try to end more like 9, because I have about half an hour worth of stuff to do. Would that be okay? Or any of Okay. Do you want 5 minutes? 5 minutes, fine. Okay. So we're taking a 5-minute break. So.